This is Aspire, Arch Street Public Radio, broadcasting interviews from our Innovate podcast series.
Mukti Bosco is co-founder of the Healing Fields Foundation. She graduated in occupational therapy from Christian Medical College and Hospital, Vellore, and has led the Women's Initiative at the Dean's Office at the Indian School of Business in Hyderabad. Mukti has presented papers in many national and international seminars and conferences, including the Clinton Global Initiative. Mukti is an Ashoka Fellow and was named the Woman Social Entrepreneur of the Year 2009 by MSDS. Co-founded in 2000 by Bosco, the Healing Field Foundation mission is to make quality healthcare affordable and accessible to all people in India, especially the poor, underprivileged, and marginalized populations. The Healing Fields Foundation project portfolio includes Healing Fields Health, feminine product distribution, nutrition interventions, as well as developing health financing programs. Here's your host, Philip Thomas.
Our guest today is Mukti Bosco. Mukti, welcome to Innovate Podcast.
Thank you, Philip.
What inspired you to go into the medical field? How did this whole begin?
I come from a family of medical people. My father was an ophthalmologist. My mother was is a public health nurse. And my father used to work with the Blind Relief Society of India. And they used to do camps all over India, in the remote corners of India, Nepal, Bhutan. And they used to go on conducting eye camps, because those days they did not have enough ophthalmologists, and cataract was one of the major causes of blindness. And so that was my background to joining the medical field. And so even as a child, I used to go around with my parents to the medical camps. And I guess that was where it started. Mm.
Now, I noticed that in your bio, you went to Christian Medical College in Vellore, which also has a strong focus on, you know, kind of grassroots health justice of sorts. How did that education contribute, or, you know, was it added inspiration, or what role did that play as you were training in the health field initially?
Oh, that was the defining moment in my life. And working in Vellore, studying and then later working in Vellore, the motto of CMC, Christian Medical College and Hospital Vellore, is not to be ministered unto, but to minister. That means not to be served unto, but to serve. That kind of ingrained in me, and I just internalized that. And through my career studying as well as working in Vellore, I always felt attracted to the community work and working with the patients, with the disabled, with the mentally ill, with the children, handicapped children. I always felt one illness could be prevented if it was before birth, if there was early diagnosis, then treatment can be started early and a lot of disability can be prevented. And many times when I would work with the mental health center with the mentally ill, as well as working with the spinal cord injured patients, always felt that it was very important to integrate the family, create awareness, talk to them about what needs to be done, as well as talk to the community around and also at the workplace, so that patients who are coming to us for treatment can go back to their communities, to their workplaces, and lead a productive life. And after I got married, I moved to Bangalore and worked at the Medico-Pastoral Association, as well as worked at the Spastic Society of Karnataka. And even there, I felt that it was extremely important for the communities to be involved with the patients. And I started the Early Intervention Center at Spastic Society. And that kind of woke me up, saying that many of the disabilities could be prevented if people had enough information and there was awareness among them when their mother was pregnant, as well as at the hospitals, so that we could avoid disability and avoid children. Preventing disability. And so, yes, Vellore was the most defining part of my life.
Now, tell us a little bit about the Healing Fields Foundation. You know, what was it that led you to form it? And in perhaps also touch on how your work in healthcare had kind of informed your development of Healing Fields.
After I left Vellore, I worked in Bangalore because I got married and I had to move to Bangalore. Then I moved to the U.S. I worked in the U.S. for some time, and I felt that my calling was in India, and I needed to come back. I just couldn't settle there. Even though my pocket was very happy, somehow there was an emptiness. And I felt that I just needed to be back because India educated me. And U.S. being a rich country can buy, if they wanted, the best of the medical health that is required for their people. Whereas India, even if they, we had such a huge population, we were not... We are still a poor country, whether we like it or not. And we couldn't, there were no proper treatment available for, especially for the poor. And that kind of left an empty space in me. And always, there's a very strong calling. And decided to come back to India. And after coming back to India, I took a maternity break. Being a homemaker, being a full-time mother for both my children, and then studied, I did my master's in healthcare management. As part of healthcare management, because I didn't want to go back into hospital, I wanted to do public health, community health, and as part of that, I started going into the villages and tribal areas, as well as urban slums, to basically understand what were the health needs of the poor. And there were two or three inspiring moments, or more like hitting rock bottom. When I was in one of the villages, one of the women came up to me who was a single mother, and the husband had died, young single widow. And she says, I'm willing to pay for health care provided I am treated with dignity and respect. So that was very important for them, because they felt that when they went into hospitals, they were not treated with respect and dignity. And the second thing that one of the other women told me was, the government has, at that point in time, this I'm talking about 20 years ago, they said the government had insurances for vehicle, crop, for buffaloes, for the unborn calf, for pigs, but there were no insurance, health insurance for people. So, and especially women. So they felt that were they lower than the animal, that the government did not care for them. And the next thing was, I was at the urban slum in Hyderabad, inner city, an urban slum in Charminar. And I was talking to a group of women there. And most of the women I mean, are Muslims in Charminar area. And the work that they focused was on embroidery, Zardozi work, as well as, or they would have taken a loan from a microcredit organization. That time, microfinance was not big, microcredit was big. So in the self-help group, would have taken a loan to buy a push cart for selling vegetables or the wares that you see in Charminar. Or there could be a sewing machine that they would have bought to stitch blouses and underskirts on contract basis, earning very little money. And I was talking to them about what did they do when there was a healthcare emergency in the family. So they said, oh, we would sell or mortgage our productive assets. So I assumed that was a sewing machine, or it could be a frame for big frame for the embroidery of their saris that they did, or it could be the push carts. And because in a rural area, productive asset would be a milch cow or goats or pigs or some of these, but urban slums, you will not have that. So I asked them if my assumption was true. So one of the women said, no, madam. It was her six-year-old son who was going to a school, a small school. She had to pull him out of school and sell him into bonded labor to a tea shop because she had to borrow 5,000 rupees for the treatment of the husband who was working in the tea shop for typhoid. And this child had to work for 12 hours a day with one meal a day. And that kind of killed my spirit.
Wow.
And I said, it's so unfair. The same city, my son was at 5 years at that, 5 years at that time.
Right.
I said, it was so unfair that a child who's just six had to do this, and that too for a preventable illness like typhoid, which could be easily treated, and the child had to be pulled out of school to pay off the debt of 5,000 rupees. And it would take a long time to pay back that debt. And that kind of was the last nail on the wall, saying that I needed to start something. So that is how Healing Fields was born. And we started off in microhealth insurance, creating a unique model of microhealth insurance, which was rolled out. And a few of the innovations that we had done was incorporated by the government, and I was given the Ashoka Fellow for that. And as we went along on the microinsurance path, we realized quickly, very quickly, we realized for insurance to work, one, we needed hospitals, we needed doctors. And in many of the places, there were no hospitals and no doctors. And the second thing that we saw was almost 70% of the illnesses are preventable. Many of the people were coming into hospitals using our insurance cards for preventable illnesses. If they had care early enough, then they need not be admitted into hospitals. And so we started a community health facilitator training program, and which has evolved now into not just a community health. We select women from villages, put them through a training program, which has two components. One is preventive health education, and the second one is entrepreneurship training. And so we train. One woman reaches out to about 250 to 300 families in her village. So till date, we have trained about 4,000 women to work with about 5 million, a population of 5 million in the states of the country. And these women go learn. It's a contact training program. They come to us for 4 days a month, and then they go back into the communities and train the other women in preventive education as to how to prevent illnesses, on nutrition, on safe drinking water practices, on how to build a toilet, from where do you take a subsidized loan, how do you access the subsidy once you've built the toilet from the government, and how do they access the various government services and the entitlements for the poor. They became the convergence point for most of the health initiatives of the government, being a facilitator to the various programs. Apart from that, we started introducing some of the sanitation and hygiene products like sanitary napkins, with a partnership with microfinance institutions, loans, subsidized loans for the community members to build toilets, as well as other health-focused products that we are going to be starting to sell now.
Now, since, you know, we're doing this via a recorded call, would you just try and help our listeners understand the geographical and the demographic context in which you work in? Because, you know, obviously in the West, it's a very different situation. Poverty, I mean, we all have poverty, but poverty is very different in India. So if you could just explain, you know, are these urban, are they rural, are they in between? You know, what is the typical, you know, kind of context look like? If you could describe it for us, then perhaps our listeners could appreciate more, you know, more richly what you're doing.
Our work mostly is centered right now in the rural areas and in the poorer states of the country. India is a country of 1.2 billion population. It's extremely complex. It is about 27 different countries stitched together. We make a beautiful quilt, colorful quilt with the different, each state has its own nuances in terms of language, in terms of food habits, in terms of livelihoods, in terms of health, in terms of superstitions, beliefs, etc. And almost 60% of our population lives in the villages. And the groups that we work, and the caste system is still prevalent in most of the areas, just about almost all the country. Caste system, communalism, as well as poverty. The people that we work with are the below poverty line or just above poverty line. And most of the people are either daily wage earners or agricultural laborers or small land holding. When I say small land holding, it can be anything below 1 acre to about 5 acres of land.
Okay.
And many of the land, small land owners would be rain-fed lands rather than having their own water sources.
Sure.
So poverty and the literacy levels are quite low. The access to health care is very poor, mainly because in the rural areas, there are not many doctors that are available or trained doctors or nurses or any kind of medical professionals. The medical professionals would be available in urban settings. It could be in bigger towns or it could be in the cities. We have a healthcare system in India, a quote-unquote universal healthcare, but it is very, very poorly staffed because we don't have enough doctors and nurses.
Right.
Apart from that, even the medicine stocks are very poor, and the facilities that are available in many of the villages in the sub-centers and the community health centers are poor. And access, there's sometimes, now there is electricity, but there is no consistent availability of electricity.
Sure.
And also, there is, in many places, there is no public transport. So these are the areas that we work in. The south of India is far, far better than the northern belt.
Sure.
And therefore, our focus has been in the poorer states of the country where the health indices and the human development indices are poor. The infant mortality and morbidity is high. Maternal mortality and morbidity is high. where there is high incidences of malnutrition, high incidence of TB, high incidence of communicable illnesses are high. These are the areas that we choose to work in.
Today's episode is brought to you by Arch Street Press and Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community. Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community is a transformative collection of essays that provide a thoughtful and engaging way to revolutionize how and what we eat. Written by a diverse group of chefs, nutritionists, and food activists, Mindful Eating offers pragmatic strategies to rebuild the connections between diet, culture, faith, the environment, and community well-being, with a focus on the deep connection between mindful eating, social justice, and sustainability. Mindful Eating for the Beloved Community, available now from Arch Street Press.
From, you know, you do some very innovative financing projects and health financing. So I'm really curious to hear a little bit about that. And I'm also specifically interested in what a health saving group is and how that works with your micro health insurance. So I realize that's a very loaded question, but if you could take a couple of minutes just to help our listeners understand the work you do in health financing.
Okay. When we started our journey in Healing Fields Foundation, this is in the year 2000, we had come up with a unique sustainable micro health insurance program where we came up with a list of illnesses for which we had pre-rated the illness, taking into consideration the signs and symptoms, the incident levels, incidences, as well as rate of incidences, as well as diagnostic protocol and treatment protocol, mm-hmm. and average length of stay in the hospital, and the diseases that required doctor's interventions, number, amount of time. And we came up with a rate card. We were the first ones to come up with a co-payment, mm-hmm. where the patient came into the hospital. We had our facilitator who was trained to receive the patient and walk them through the hospital, the processes in the hospital, stayed with them and the doctor was talking to them. Even though the language the doctor may talk would be the same, but the patient would not be able to understand and the doctor may not have enough time to sit and explain to the patient about the illness. And our facilitators were taught on all the 52 conditions to understand the condition and explain it to the patient. And also if they needed hospitalization, because in India, insurance pays only for hospitalization. It had to be 24 hours or more. And and there are not many policies, regulations on the fees that a hospital could charge you for a condition, for an illness. You go to three different hospitals with the same illness, there could be three different type of diagnosis that would be that you are asked to do, diagnosis test, and the charges would be three different charges. And so most of the time, there's a World Bank report which says that 30% of the population is pushed below poverty line with just one incident of hospitalization. And so when these patients came into the hospital and if they had to be admitted, the facilitator would inform them what is the amount that they would have to bring in at the time of discharge, the co-payment, which was about 25% of the total fees. And that kind of relieved them of the pressure of having to borrow at very high interest rate or mortgage their assets. And because they would have enough time to get the money. And the facilitator, after the patient got discharged, would go back into the community as to follow up also. And as earlier I had mentioned, we had done this during from 2004 to 2008. And we quickly realized for hospitalization to work, we needed to have doctors in hospitals, and in many of the places, there were no doctors in hospitals. And therefore, we started the community health facilitator training program and entrepreneurship training program. Mm. And as part of that, we work with self-help groups and microfinance groups. We are not a microfinance institution, but mm-hmm. we partner with microfinance institutions and self-help groups, where we also form the women into smaller groups, about 10 to 20 women, where the community health facilitator goes and does a health education. Right. And as part of the health education, she also forms health savings group, where the money is kept within the village. We created a network of hospitals and pharmacies, and we negotiated discounted rates so that a person can take a loan if they didn't have money, small amounts. It could be as small as 200 to 500 rupees, mm-hmm. and they could go to visit a qualified doctor mm-hmm. so that at the first incident of illness, they could get quality treatment mm-hmm. and could buy a full course of medication rather than taking part course and then complication arises. And so that is the program that we have started, and it is doing well. Apart from the community health facilitator and entrepreneurship training, we also have another program. Once a person, a woman, has completed the first year of training, and we go through a selection criteria, put them through a interview, and select few of the women and upgrade their skills to become an acute care provider in the villages. Sure. So they become a first responder to any kind of health emergency. This, we are doing it in partnership with Stanford Emergency Medicine. And we have launched a pilot in 3 districts in Bihar and Uttar Pradesh, mm-hmm. A few of the most poorest states in the country and most populous states. And these women have been given training, not only in the clinical aspects, but also what kind of medication to be given, screening, as well as treatment. Mm-hmm. And they are also trained to use a decision support on a mobile app, which is on a web app. We have a doctor monitoring what she is doing, and in case of an antibiotic that has to be prescribed, then it triggers a phone call to the doctor. The doctor talks to the patient and the community health facilitator, and the medicines are prescribed and for a nominal fee.
Sure.
So this is something that we would be scaling up as well.
What are some of the biggest challenges that you're facing as you try to provide sustainable health care to the poor in these areas?
Oh, there are a lot of challenges.
But perhaps maybe the top three, you know?
The top three would be, one is the places that we have chosen to work are difficult places, like right. I had talked about earlier. There is very poor infrastructure in terms of not only healthcare, but also in terms of public transportation or any kind of distribution. Now, for us to be able to provide products and services to the last mile, supply chain distribution is one of the biggest challenges, because it becomes very expensive to provide, to distribute products as simple as sanitary napkins or whole pregnancy home kits. So right now we're working on that. That's a big challenge. The second big challenge is connectivity, networks. I talked about a decision support and to be able to, decision support app, to be able to activate those. That is, again, is one is it is expensive, which the poor cannot afford. And so that is the other biggest challenge. And also, like I talked about, the distribution that holds right even for medicines. as well as the third and the most important challenge is resources. When I say resources, what I mean is to get professional people to work in these areas, doctors and nurses, because these are quite rural. And unlike the West, rural means there is not much facilities available, no safe drinking water, there are no transportation, there are no proper schools for the kids. So therefore, there are not many people who would want to go and work in these areas. So that is our third biggest challenge.
Now, you were named an Ashoka Fellow in 2007. How has your time with Ashoka impacted your work today?
Oh, Ashoka is, I mean, Ashoka has been one of our great supporters. So when there is a challenge, one of the biggest solace that I get with Ashoka is when I face a challenge, I pick up the phone and speak to other Ashoka fellows and to Ashoka directly, saying, I'm facing this now. Do you know of anybody who has faced this and cracked this? As well as to even have people, to have a network that you could, who could understand your work and be supportive and be able to help you think through. I think that is one of the biggest value that Ashoka has given. Mm-hmm. And the second biggest value Ashoka has given is opened up and their networks and being an Ashoka fellow. I mean, there is a instant recognition that maybe you're doing something good, something which is credible and something which is very important. Right. And therefore, immediately we get doors opened for us. And the third important thing is with the kind of technical and professional support that Ashoka provides us periodically, that helps us think through our own vision, our own processes,
right.
Our own strategies, which we, I mean, which always in the social sector space takes a backseat. We just do the work because we work, there's so much work that needs to be done, so many problems we solve. We just get focused on that and we just go and keep doing what needs to be done. But then if we have to scale up, create the impact, and if we need to be able to reach a lot more, then we need to have a strategy. We need to have processes in place. And that is where one of the greatest value that Ashoka has added to me and to Healing Fields Foundation is to bring those skill sets to us. If not, we would not be able to afford to buy those skill sets. I was part of Ashoka Tech Globalizer X, and that really opened up avenues for us. Where when we started, our 5 years roadmap was put in a strategy. They helped us develop a strategy and also a technology strategy. And now we have started moving on a technology platform, starting with a finance ERP that we have put in, where there's a lot of ease in operation, and come up with an integrated platform where we would be monitoring our operations, as well as rolling out different technologies like for the basic care provider, the app, etc. As well as I was part of another initiative of Ashoka with Boehringer Ingelheim, and as part of that, the different KPIs, the KRIs, and the processes was put in place. They helped us put in place. I mean, when I say put in place, they just trigger us to think in the corporate terms, and that helps us operationalize and put in the processes and helps us to monitor our own work effectively. Sure. So Ashoka, yes, has been extremely valuable.
So in closing, if you could perhaps tell us a bit about some of the newer projects that you're currently working on. And, you know, for some of our other listeners, perhaps if someone wants to get involved with you, what are the ways in which they can get involved with what you're doing. So one is, you know, the new projects that you're working on, and how could people get involved with you?
Okay. There are two new projects that we are working on right now. One is a health entrepreneurship program, a training, and also setting up a supply chain and distribution model so that access to quality products is created for the remote villages. And in the process, our community health entrepreneurs can earn a living and the whole program can become sustainable. So that is a project that we are working on. And the second project we are working on is a basic care, acute care provider program. We are upgrading the skills of the women to become an acute care provider with Stanford Emergency Medicine. And the pilot is being launched, so we are hoping to scale it up. So these are the two projects. We are launching with our 4,000 women whom we have already trained to work in 4,000 villages, reaching to about 5 million population. And we are hoping that we would be scaling these programs to other areas as well. Now coming to the second part of your question is, how can your listeners help and support? We are looking for somebody who has experience in setting up supply chain and distribution program, possibly like the Amazon or the Flipkart.
Right.
How do you cost effectively do this? Because there's very less cost, very less that the affordability of the people is minimum. And I believe that we need to be able to provide quality products within what they can afford. So we are definitely looking at help in terms of supply chain and distribution. We are looking for help in terms of scaling up of acute care provider programs where we would definitely require support in terms of professional support as well as financial support for the acute care provider program to scale it up, because we believe that that would change the whole landscape in terms of creating access to the poor. With a community health facilitation, entrepreneurship and acute care provider program, this could be taken across different geographies. And to be, as we scale, we need to use technology tools, and we are looking for converting all of our training programs on an e-learning platform, a facilitated e-learning platform, because we work with adults using adult learning principles, and there is a lot of monitoring that happens at the field level because they take home projects and assignments that the women go back into their communities and do. And one of the challenges that we face in the training is to be able to have consistent delivery of the content and standardized content. So we are definitely looking at help in terms of converting all of our program into an interactive e-learning platform.
Sure.
To summarize, there are three things. One is in supply chain and distribution help. People who have experience in that, if they could volunteer and help us with that, that would be awesome. The second thing would be in terms of an e-learning platform, and the third, creating an e-learning platform, and the third one is professional and financial support for the basic care provider program.
Mukti Bosco, it's truly been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for making time to speak with us. We at Innovate Podcast wish you all the best and the healing fields in everything that you do to serve the world around you.
Thank you. Thank you, Philip. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for joining us today. Our library of interviews and a range of further resources are available at our website, innovatepodcast.org. Aspire and Innovate are produced in partnership with Ashoka, Innovators for the Public, the Kellogg Fellows Leadership Alliance, the Philadelphia Social Innovations Journal, and by Arch Street Press for PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.